thing, so.
Okay.
How are you? We never ask each other. Sure, we have some pleasantries. I know we live together, but they don't know how you are.
My life is in shambles.
That's not true. She just got a job.
That's why my life is in shambles. Okay. I'm just adjusting to a new schedule. The job is fine. The job itself is fine, but it's like, surprise, now you have to put on slacks every morning and make conversation with your coworkers while you look for the tea kettle.
That's honestly my nightmare. I mean, the wearing slacks part is what I was thinking of. I can't imagine a world in which I have to wake up and decide between dress pants, which are for women inherently uncomfortable, or a skirt, which are for me specifically inherently uncomfortable.
Yes. Dress pants are not made for human women's bodies, except somehow I have miraculously found one very good pair of dress slacks that at Nordstrom. Yeah, I love them. They were what I was wearing today. You didn't see me because I immediately
rushed past.
Took them off because I knew it was going to come stuff my face and I didn't want to get things.
It's dinner time. Anyway, you want to talk about book news?
I sure. Well, how are you doing?
Okay, I guess. For book news, which I prepared for once.
I'm so proud of her.
Look at me. It's only because Sally now has a job with a salary, so I felt like I needed to pick up I felt like I needed to, do my fair share of work here. Okay, so for book news, a book that's coming out this week is Children of Blood and Bone by, and I might mispronounce this, Tomi Adeyemi. It actually came out early. Yeah, all books go on sale on Tuesdays, I think that's the thing. So I think it was already published. I don't know if anyone's read it, but this book is interesting because it basically, before it was even published, had already garnered a movie deal and, like, had created this big bidding war in the major publishing houses. And we don't really know what it's about, or at least I don't. It is West African inspired, so it's sort of in the vein of Akata Warrior and Akata Witch, it sounds like a little bit, but the synopsis is basically that it's like dark magic, danger, fantasy, there's a girl and there's a rogue princess and a ruthless king and the crown prince, so just like a lot of your stereotypical young adult fantasy characters.
Yeah.
And basically it's just like hyped as hell, which I don't ever trust anything that has any sort of hype attached to it. We both just read, I think I edited this out the last time we talked about it, but we both just read The Power by
Naomi Alderman,
which is also a much hyped book, and we hated it.
And also awful.
It was so shitty. And obviously I don't want to, like, pass judgment on this book, like, just because it's hype doesn't mean that it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think books, especially when they're hyped within the publishing industry, they're being hyped because they are, something that is going to sell.
Yes.
Like, the reason this sparked a bidding war and is already attached to a movie deal is because the people within the publishing industry probably assume it's going to make them a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason they'd ever be willing to pay for it. Which isn't to say that the sorts of things that, like, will bring in a lot of money are bad, because there are a lot of really good trends right now.
Especially
in, like, young adult fiction, and it's really cool that they think that it's interesting that they're predicting a book by a Nigerian-American author, like, that's set in a Nigeria-esque
mm-hmm.
setting is going to be popular, and that's, like, that's really positive, because it's a move away from sort of the more westernized dystopia and fiction and fantasy that we have been force-fed for the last 20 years.
Force-fed is a good term.
But also, like, if this tells you anything, the people who are making the movie are the same ones who made, what was it? The Fault in Our Stars, The Maze Runner.
Twilight. Like, every...
All successful movies, I'll warrant, but, like, should they have been?
Should they have been? The Fault in Our Stars. Did I actually see that movie? I can't remember. I don't think so. Twilight movies. Shitty. The Maze Runner movies? Entertaining. Like, subjectively entertaining, objectively shitty. Like, it's... I also don't want to pass judgment on it because I haven't read it. Mm-hmm. And there is a possibility that it is both very good and going to make a lot of money, but I just, like, super doubt it.
Usually that's a Venn diagram with a very slim, like, yeah, intersection.
With, like, what would even be in there.
Things that are actually good and make a lot of money.
Yeah.
I was gonna say Harry Potter, but Harry Potter is on a downward spiral these days.
Oh my god, speaking of which, I am reading Harry Potter and the Cursed Child right now, and it is fucking wild. I didn't know anything about it, and it is an experience and a half. That's irrelevant, though. I'm not inclined to pass, like, I don't want to pass judgment, but I am inclined to leave that it is not going to be, like, a particularly good novel. Just, like, on the way that, like, The Fault in Our Stars isn't a particularly good novel, and The Maze Runner is a very bad novel. Like, things that are popular, but also, like...
It also puts my hackles up, sorry to interrupt you, that it is named with the exact naming convention of every young adult book these days, which is blank of blank and blank.
I know.
Like, noun of noun and noun. Usually the last two nouns are something like grim. Like blood, and or bone, or ash, or dust, or...
City of bones. Yeah. City of ash.
Exactly. And usually the first noun is something totally irrelevant. Children? Who are the children?
But, like, that being said, like, we've, like you said, we've been force-fed so much shitty fantasy that I'm, like, happy that shitty fantasy is at least transitioning to being, like, not Eurocentric.
Yes.
Because I would much rather, like... Because, like, I read a lot of shitty YA when I was younger, and it was in the vein of The Fault in Our Stars, The Maze Runner. I read all of the City of Ash and whatever books.
White people doing
things. White people doing things. And, like, that affected me in a lot of ways. That was the type of media I consumed, and I had to unlearn a lot of that as I got older, and I think it would be really good. It will be really good. Like, I'm really excited to think of, like, my niece growing up in a world where, like, the popular media is people who don't look like her. And don't live life, a life like she does. So, like, yes, it may not be, like, good. And I also, that raises, like, a whole conversation about what we qualify as good just because we think it's, like, socially, like, politically correct or, like, socially relevant or, like, it's gonna hit a bunch of, like, affirmative action boxes. That's a whole other conversation which we cannot unpack in our brief segment of book news, which has already gone on for too long. I am bitter and not hopeful about the publishing industry, like, ever getting better. Like, I want it to, and I hope that it does, but I just, like, don't think that it will.
Well, it's so based on nepotism that it's, yeah, like, become impossible for outsiders to break in and change it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, like, why we really need to focus on, like, small presses. Like, just off the top of my head, like, Lee and Low Books, they do mostly, like, younger children, but they have a lot of diversity initiatives, and I think they mostly publish, like, books by diverse, whatever that word even means, sure, authors. And they're doing, like, a really great job, and they have a really lot of fun titles. So if you keep that in there, if anybody wants to look at that. So, yes, super exciting that at least our mainstream media is going to get diverse.
Yeah.
Okay, that went on for a really long time. I need to, like...
Who cares? It's not like we have anything to say about Wheel of Time. Is that our theme song?
I don't know what that was.
Okay, well,
it was I get beautiful. Knocked down.
I get up again.
Ain't never gonna keep me down.
To just launch into our
we
podcast
should
without
introduce ourselves.
And about 20 minutes in, I'd be like,
Welcome to the podcast.
Also, if you didn't know, this is Everybody Hates Rand. If you want to know why we hate Rand, listen to the last episode because we ranted about it in detail for way too long. I'm Emily Jushaw, your friendly neighborhood. I don't know, your friendly neighborhood, not Spider-Man because I hate spiders. What are you? Who are you? Who are we all?
Who are we all? Who am I? Central identity question of many works of literature, including Hamlet by William Shakespeare. I wrote an essay about that my junior year of high school.
About how Hamlet is about identity crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I was 17, so I was like, look at how smart I am. My professor was like, fine, she's better than the rest of the class. My professor, my teacher.
I wrote when I was like 19, my freshman year. I took a Shakespeare class, and I wrote the most stereotypical old paper ever about how Romeo and Juliet is about, like, passion and how passion can mean violence, but also, like, love. And I turned it in and was like, that was the shittiest thing I've ever written in my entire life. And my professor agreed.
I think so.
And yeah, you bet was.
What a lunatic. I love her. Okay, I am Sally Goodger. Yes, that's me. I am Sally Goodger, like Badger. I've been doing that a lot at work lately.
Oh.
Goodger, like Badger. I'm very tired today because I've joined the corporate workforce.
Capitalism is killing us all.
I would say that I've sold out, but I'm actually doing nonprofit work, so it's like a little bit of
So actually you all have so
actually,
sold out.
Actually, no, the nonprofit industry has many problems. Okay, reintroducing myself. I'm Sally Goodger, and I'm tired today.
I'm leaving all that stuff in.
No, I'm going to, my people that were going to listen to it, they're not. Okay, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah.
This is Everybody Hates Rand.
I said that already. Stop getting my lines.
Okay.
I'm sorry. We're both tired, so we're going to keep this a little short. We did, however, last time completely skip over Rand's dream sequence. I don't know why we
just didn't talk about it. Oh, yeah, I had something to say about that, too.
Sorry, what did you have to say about it?
So this chapter opens with Resident Ginger Randall Thor having one of his infamous dream sequences. And it's really interesting because the chapter doesn't frame it. It's not like Rand is sleeping and he had this dream. You're just, like, thrown in media res into the dream sequence, which is interesting. So it's one of those moments, like, I remember, admittedly I was skimming it, so whatever, but I, like, read it for a while and I was like, oh, like, took me a minute to realize it was a dream sequence, which is cool.
Yeah, especially because, like, there's a whole level of, the whole paradox of this dream sequence, which this whole dream is very, like, paradoxical. It's, like,
for sure.
Rand is running up the Penrose steps of a labyrinth being chased, but also he's conscious that he's dreaming, but he's not allowed to be conscious that he's dreaming, or it begins to, like, warp this world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that is. It's sort of, again, this dream logic that applies throughout The Eye of the World and sort of The Great Hunt, where it felt like Robert Jordan didn't really know what he was doing with it. But, yeah, I'm sorry I totally interrupted you.
That's okay. That is fine. Interrupt me as much as you want.
No.
I don't mind. So, yeah, that's interesting in and of itself, but this dream sequence, like, inevitably all dream sequences or all of these periods that are so infamous in fantasy for this, like, I want to use the word liminal, because it is kind of liminal. You get in this, like, it's either, like, fever dreams, hallucinations, actual dreams, like, a lot of, like, warped logic happens in fantasy for some reason. And, like, inevitably that will take us to a maze of some sort. It, like, always happens. And I was, like, thinking about this, and I was like, why is it always a maze? And I am, as I think I've mentioned before, taking about 7 years to read this Encyclopedia of World Mythology. And there's, like, a section on labyrinths, obviously, and it talks about Daedalus and stuff. But it mentions, like, labyrinth in the reference to a mandala. And a mandala, like, is very specific to, like, Hindu and Buddhist mythology, of course, but in, like, a more, like, generalized understanding in, like, mythology studies, like, mandala has meant some type of, like, sacred circle of some sort that, like, has to do with, like, oneness and, like, truth. I think, I don't have my book in front of me, I could go get it, but I'm not going to. About destiny and eternity and stuff like that. So it's just kind of interesting.
Religious stuff.
Mythic stuff. I'm not doing a very good job as resident academic here at Everybody Hates Rand, but
no, I feel you. I was also just reading about how mazes are one of the, like, archetypes.
Good word.
In mythology. So, like, Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung, like, studied them as part of this, like, overarching story that the world is sort of obsessed with, and you know, where there are, like, these little things like floods and virgin births that are in every sort of crop up in every mythology, and labyrinths are one of those, like, mazes or some representation of the maze being trapped somewhere where you just, like, can't find your way out. So it's like all of Wheel of Time, it's all very archetypal. That's a hard word.
Just on the note of archetypes, my favorite professor, who I reference all the time, talked about archetypes, like, I just really like the phrasing that he used, which is that they're, like, grooves in the collective human conscious.
Ooh, yeah, that's cool.
Consciousness, they're, like, grooves in our consciousness, which I just really like that phrasing.
Yeah, so for some reason, we're obsessed with mazes.
Yeah, which they're cool.
Yeah, they're, like, really cool. I mean, just, like, a really neat setting, generally, but...
Yeah, so...
Also, they play somehow on this, like, Campbell talks about how they're, like, the two... He borrowed this from Freud, who I mostly think is bullshit, but there is, like, some truth to the idea that we're basically motivated by, like, either fear or desire, like, either aversion or attraction, like magnets, basically. Yeah. And so with mazes, there's something in us that is both attracted to them and afraid of them.
Yeah, it's, like, frightening to think... It's, like, because I can see the appeal. It's, like, frightening to, like, go into a place where, like, you might not be able to find your way out. Find your way out, but there's also, like, such, like, a delicious challenge and, like, going yeah. into a maze and, like, solving it. So, like, I can, yeah, see the appeal.
Yeah, and it's fun here where Grant does the, he's in the maze and he's like, oh, I'll just use that trick where you only turn the one way. And as soon as he starts applying real world logic to this dream logic place, he immediately runs into Balzamon.
Yeah.
And that's, like, sort of what, almost what sparks the confrontation. Which isn't much of a confrontation. Basically, Balzamon just yells at him indecipherably about the Eye of the World and the Great Serpent, and...
Yeah.
Rand says, this is a dream, and then Balzamon, like, goes, turns into ash, and then Rand is Balzamon in another maze of mirrors. Also, there's a whole thing where, like, Rand gets pricked by a thorn, and it's real in the real world, too. And it's all just... This is all, like, such a stereotypical fantasy dream sequence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't even, like, it's so typical that I, like, can't even think of everything that it's referencing.
I know. There's just, like, so much. It's, like, very, like, fairy tale, too. Like, you get pricked yeah. by a thorn in the maze, and there's something. There's always something about thorns.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. Thorns are archetypal, too. Anyway, so that's the dream sequence, and kind of we'll skim over what we already talked about with the ship and pirates, and get over to Whitebridge.
I was gonna sing a Whitebridge song, but then I was like, what would Whitebridge's song be?
I don't know.
Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin.
That's Bale Dumont coming into Whitebridge every time. Tell me that I'm wrong, though. Tell me that I'm wrong.
I think you're right if we apply it to almost any other setting besides this fairly rural, okay, weird...
Fine. Tarvalon.
Bale Dumont going into, like, Ilion, I don't know, or some shit like that.
Yeah, that's true. Bale Dumont fighting the Shanshan outside of...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Pretty badass, right? Bale Dumont is the coolest character.
Oh, Bale Dumont. Yeah, he's totally a Led Zeppelin type character.
Totally.
You know, he's got a mixtape of...
That he's like, all right, lads, songs. Put it on.
Yeah.
And then he, like, holds up his stolen trollic weapons. It's pretty, it's cool. There you go. End scene.
Yeah, love him.
Okay, Whitebridge.
Whitebridge, yeah, fairly, like, not a huge city. Rand compares it to Bearlawn in terms of size. It's, like, one signifying feature is that it's built, it's, like, surrounding the end of this one bridge that goes over the river. So kind of like, we're in New York, kind of like Dumbo at the end of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yes. You heard it here first. Whitebridge is Dumbo.
Well, actually, I think Whitebridge is probably more exciting. Dumbo is a trash place.
I'm okay. I like being in Dumbo for, like, 10 minutes. Like, when I had some friends in town, we went and ate cake by the riverfront, and, oh, like, that nice. Was super lovely, and we were there for, like, 20 minutes.
Remember when I took you there, and we were wandering around for an hour because we didn't know how to get on the train?
Yeah, that was a... But I did pee in Dumbo.
Yeah, so. We also all needed to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, so. And so we found, like, this weird little park. My first experience in Dumbo was confusing.
Yeah.
But enjoyable.
I'm glad you were courageous enough to go back.
We'll all take you there. We also saw jet skiers.
What the fuck?
I know. And I was like, is it even legal to jet ski here? They were doing it. There were four of them. Okay, that's
New
off
York.
Topic.
Who cares?
Yeah. The law doesn't exist. Everything's legal. That's New Jersey. I'm
so sorry. Anyway, so this bridge that goes over the river, obviously it's white. And no one really knows what it's made of. Like, it's sort of glass-looking, but it's not glass. It all looks like it's made out of, like, one piece, and it's kind of, like, looks too delicate to really be supporting the weight. So that's all
that's all very paradoxical and sort of, like, indicative of Age of Legends architecture. Like, Robert Jordan has these two types of ruins that he's playing with, which we talked about ruins extensively in the last episode, where it's sort of, like, this old statues that are crumbling and sort of things that are more signifiers of our world, almost. Statues crumbling, old animal bones, stuff like that that's either super ancient or a little more recent than the Age of Legends. And then there's the Age of Legends stuff that's a little more, like, futuristic and sort of gives you a different vibe because, unlike the stone ruins, it doesn't, like, plunge you into the past so much as plunge you into this future.
It's
that
like
is
this,
also the past.
It's like the... because it is the past, but it's, like, an alternate future past.
Yeah.
Like, it bends, like, the notions of, like, future and past really interestingly.
Which,
in terms
like,
of
duh,
aesthetic.
That's the title of the book, Wheel
of Time. Wheel
of Time.
Time is a wheel. Time passes, future, future is past. Yeah, okay. The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, my dude. Do you think Robert Jordan was like, look at how hilarious this tongue twister is, and then flipped off everybody who ever read his book and was like, the wheel weaves as the wheel
I'm
gonna
bet
wills.
You $10 that Robert Jordan never said that sentence out loud until he was already like four books in.
I'm dying. So, yeah.
And only then did his wife say, you know, it's really tough to say your whole little catchphrase thing. And he was like, is it? The wheel weaves as the
wheel wheels is the wave wolves.
What the fuck?
Who let me write this?
I just fucked up. Anyway, so yeah, Age of Legends architecture. There's some, like, other stuff that we come across throughout the rest of the series. Like, the Stone of Tyr, our, like, fortress that doesn't, cannot be penetrated until, spoiler alert, it is.
Matt does it. I guess all the boys do it, but Matt expects.
No, Perrin doesn't.
Okay, fine. Perrin's too much of a loser
no,
to
yeah,
penetrate the fortress.
Doing some shit.
He's with Fael, isn't he?
Yeah, he's like.
He's like falling in love or some shit.
Or something. He's having a romantic arc.
Oh, yeah! I totally forgot about what happens to Fael at the end of book three.
Yeah, because no one gives a shit.
Yeah, and I would read that and I was like, am I supposed to care? Moving on. Where's Matt blowing up a wall?
Yeah, literally. Oh, I can't wait to get to the Stone
we
of
are
Tyr
in
sequence.
Book one. But look, the Stone of Tyr sequence is the best 100 pages of fantasy ever written. Probably.
I concur.
It's so good. I read like 10 pages of Wheel of Time at a time.
Sure.
But I read all of the Stone of Tyr in one sitting. I was like,
because you can't
tattoo this on my eyeballs. I want to read it permanently.
Okay, anyway, Whitebridge. There's another city that they go to. I think it's Farmadding. Farmadding has, like, a Terangreal of some sort that basically stops, channeling from occurring within the city.
Weird.
Sort of like what happens in the Steadings, the Ogier, I don't know why I just went to pronounce that French.
Ogier. Loyal, the Ogier.
How do you pronounce it? Ogier?
I thought it was Ogier, but I like Ogier now. We're saying it Ogier.
Fuck. I've been avoiding French pronunciations. Read Moiraine.
Moiraine.
So I'm not going to get caught up in this.
Ogier is gonna be my alias.
Ogier isn't even in the glossary. What the fuck? Did he think it was so easy we could all pronounce it?
Just what about the OG? Just the OG?
The word fist is in the glossary. But
are you
not
fucking joking
okay,
me?
Okay, it's talking about a military unit of Trollocs, but as if I care.
Yeah, I need to know how to pronounce Ogier. I know about fisting. Urban Dictionary, Robert.
I've had the sex talk, Robert. Not about fisting, I'll admit, but I've seen Game of Thrones. I know what fisting is. If there's a sex thing, it has been done on Game of Thrones, and therefore I know about it.
True. Or, okay, no, I can't make that comparison.
What?
Doesn't matter. I was gonna say, or Outlander, but Outlander is actually pretty vanilla. And shitty.
Speaking of hyped books,
honestly, okay, fisting.
Okay, like the Ogier Steadings, there's a Terangreal that prevents people from channeling. Although it's like a little bit of a different feeling. Our protagonists will go there at some point in the series and they'll describe it as being different from the Steadings. But the point is there are all these, like, relics from the Age of Legends that influence these various settings in really interesting ways. Whitebridge is sort of bleh. It's just, like, sort of a visual thing. but, like, it lends this aura of, like, mystery and intrigue. And, of course, it's sort of this little interlude in Whitebridge is sort of a threshold to Randon Matt's, you know, sort of splinter-off journey.
Mm-hmm. It's the so-called death of the mentor thing.
Death of the mentor, which is sort of fun because you'd expect as this series begins that the death of the mentor would be Moiraine. Rain. But of course, Robert Jordan manages to give us two mentor deaths in this series. First, Tom, which is a fake death, and Moiraine later on, which is also a fake death.
You done pulled the wool over my eyes twice, Robert.
Are there any mentors that actually die in Wheel of Time?
Well, I would know.
I'm thinking. Tough to say.
Has anyone died yet?
Has anyone died in Wheel of Time?
No, where I am.
I see.
Like, a lot of people die all the time. Robert Jordan just killed Perrin's entire family because he's, like, too many names to remember. It was like, fucking slaughter him, I guess. Firing squad, line him up.
Yeah, start true, though. Robert Jordan, for having the immense cast of characters that he does, like, doesn't really kill anyone off.
Yeah, very interesting.
Until, like, obviously the last battle when some people will die. I think that's not a spoiler.
People will die in the battle?
People will die in the big end-of-the-world battle. People will die in Tarmageddon, which I didn't figure out until 5 years ago. Sounds like Armageddon.
Armageddon, yeah.
I'm so stupid.
You are not.
I am a little bit.
We're all a little bit stupid.
Whatever. So they get to Whitebridge, brief convo with Bail Domon, who basically offers them, like, a gig. He gives them back their money that he took from them, although not the coins that Moiraine gave them.
Yeah.
He did a whole money change switcheroo in the back.
Who knows what he's
doing. Basically, he gives them back their money and is like, you basically earned your fare because you were entertaining my crew, my semi-mutinous crew, through this entire terrible river voyage. And he says, you are welcome to come with me to Ilion, which is going to be my next stop. And Tom's really interested in that, so much so that he gets, like, severely distracted thinking about it. But Rand is really set on moving on to Camelin, which is where they agreed they're going to meet Moiraine, basically. Mm-hmm. Although, I don't know, do they ever actually have a conversation with Moiraine that's, like...
Now that you mention it, I don't think so.
I think they all just sort of know the plan, which is we're going to be ending, we're going to be going to Tar Valon by way of Camelin.
By way of Camelin.
And so they've just sort of figured... We'll get to Camelin and Moiraine will do the rest, which, to be honest, that's what happens.
Yeah, but it's also, like, a pretty big assumption, being like...
I know.
You know what? Traveling from, I don't know, Ely, Nevada to New York City by way of Chicago? Sure, I guess.
Imagine rolling up to New York City, and you're like, my mentor figure
my
will
mentor
find
figure
me.
My mentor figure will find me.
I have trust. I'm going to check into this Best Western.
I love the Best Western. Don't hate on Best
Western. I'm not hating on Best Western. I'm comparing Best Western to the greatest inn in the series. Actually, no, that's the Nine Horse Hitch. Let's be honest.
The Good Night's Ride.
Ooh. Ooh.
Very sexy. Ooh. Fill in the blanks for yourself, kids.
There's also a little interlude where, what's his name? The guy who...
Gelb?
Gelb, some whatever his name is. Rand stepped on him, and that's his defining characteristic.
Hilarious.
That he got stepped on and is angry about it, but also he's like a lazy skunk who was always sleeping
lazy
on.
Skunk! Oh my god!
What?
That was so good.
I call him a rat fink. That's my mom's favorite.
Rat fink. He's a lazy skunk, that
he's
rat,
a rat
fink.
Fink.
What does that even mean?
Rat fink?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Don't Google it.
I have to know. It's a fiction or fictional character? Rathfink is one of the several Hot Rod characters created by artist Ed Big Daddy Roth.
Kill me.
He's an anti-hero answer to Mickey Mouse.
What the shit?
So...
Did you ever watch Biker Mice from Mars?
Why the fuck would I have ever watched that? This is genuinely
frightening.
This is genuinely upsetting.
I really don't like this.
I don't like it. I'm closing the tab.
Just send one of those pictures to your mom, no context.
The amount of times my mother has used rat fink as a derogatory term is hilarious.
Now you know she's calling you a fucking demon.
I don't think she knows. I think she just thinks it's a funny combination of words.
Okay.
Well, I guess we'll find out, though. I should ask her. Yeah, Gelb, this treacherous rat.
Lazy skunk.
Think lazy skunk, any number of bad adjectives.
He's a fucking bitch.
Okay. Was going a little far.
Is it?
He's just a side character.
Florence Gelb, fucking goober.
Whatever, he's, like, upset and Damon has him arrested, basically. Or he just kicks him off the boat, yeah. I think is what happens.
Yeah, he does. He's like, you can't.
He's like, get off anymore. And has, like, some of his guys, like, escort him off the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom and co. are like, oh, well, that was dramatic, but we don't have anything to do with this man's livelihood, so peace out. And they go looking for, like, an inn to regroup. Tom chooses the grossest inn around, which they enter, and we meet our first unpleasant innkeeper, who's kind of like this gross guy who immediately, like, when Tom asks him what the town gossip is, he, like, sits down and is like, let me tell you about my bunions.
Yeah, it's super nasty.
Like, my feet hurt.
Like, everybody's feet hurt. Yeah, don't everybody's tell me about your feet.
Are in pain all the time, you weirdo.
He's super gross.
He's gross, the inn's kind of gross, but Tom, in one of his many lessons about not just glee manning, but spying, is like, this is at the very, in the very center of town, so anyone who passes through here is going to, like, be known by this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom asks about, basically in a really roundabout way, he starts asking, like, trying to get at it, and then Rand basically is like, have you seen our friends? It's a woman who's tiny and a lesbian witch, and there's a man who is really mean and tall, mm-hmm. and then there's two young ladies, one of whom has a braid and could probably kill you, and the other one, less, could kill you.
And the other one is my girlfriend, and I don't let her make any of her own decisions because I'm a piece of garbage.
Yeah, and also Perrin, I forgot he was
busy. Yeah, and he's like, and this, like, puppy. Our curly-haired dog.
And there's a big boy. Just there's a real...
There's a big boy!
Just a real big boy. He's got an axe.
He's a big boy with an axe.
Yeah. Anyway, innkeeper's like, nah, I haven't seen them, but some other people have been asking about them, and that said, I don't really want you here anymore because the people who are asking about them were weird-looking.
Which is hilarious.
I'm really good at synopsis.
You're incredible at synopsis. One time, Emily's like, synopsized? What's the verb of that?
Synopsized
an entire book for me, just like standing in the doorway of her room, and it was a life-changing experience.
Which book?
So funny. And what is it, like, the Beasts
of... Oh, that one.
Night and Dark.
That was an easy book to synopsize, because it was full of shit.
Okay, White Bridge! And so then the innkeeper is like, you can't be here anymore, my dudes, because the creepy people are looking for your friends. And then he, like, walks away. He's like, get out of my inn. And then...
He's basically like, finish your drinks and leave.
Finish your drinks and... You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Ooh, what accent was
that? I don't know. And then they get up to leave. But then Florence Gelb, lazy skunk, is in the common room spreading lies about everybody's favorite pirate uncle, Bail Damon, because he's like, Bail Damon's gonna talk shit about me, but fuck you, I'm gonna talk shit about you first.
Pirates are the most gossipy.
He's like, I'm gonna make sure Bail Damon doesn't work anymore in this town, and Bail Damon's like, no, I'm gonna make sure you don't work anymore in this town. It's very dramatic.
And these boys are just in the middle of this pirate drama
in 4 acts.
And there's a whole conflict going on, because Rand just wants to go to Camelin, but Tom's like, you know what, Ilion sounds like a pretty sweet deal right about now, because we've got Trollocs on our asses. Like,
yeah, let's fucking... He's like, they're about to announce the Great Hunt for the Horn.
Yeah, boys. You guys aren't gonna be good gleemen, but...
But we're gonna do our best.
But yeah, like, I mean, it'll get you away.
There's an alternate timeline where Mac Thon became Tom Marilyn 2.
Tom Marilyn 2.0. Boys in the house.
Tom Marilyn 2, boys in the house.
And Rand.
Rand became dead.
Yeah, what's hopefully Rand's destiny?
Rand's destiny. In this alternate timeline where Matt is Tom, Rand would be, I wanted to say Ruark, but that's too good.
Yeah, no, don't they, in book 2, they do that whole, special stone where they get to see all the their alternate timelines. Sadly, this one doesn't come up.
Yeah, this one doesn't come up. The one where, yeah, Rand is a gleeman.
Here's what I think would happen in the Ilion timeline. Obviously, the world would end in a few years because the Dragon Reborn wouldn't, you
know. Do his dragoning instead
of his shit.
Juggling, yeah.
This is all assuming, of course, that the boys make it to Ilion and successfully evade the Dark One until the world ends. Which, like, I don't know. There's something there about how if the Dark One had just left Rand alone, maybe he, like, if he hadn't sent Trollocs, then it would have been pretty tough to uproot Rand and company from the Two Rivers, and maybe he just would have stayed there, and the world fucking would have ended anyway. But no, he had sent Trollocs after them.
Well, that's just, like, the thing in myth. It's, like, the self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Where it's, like Oedipus's dad is, like, my son's gonna kill me. So he fucking binds his feet and sends his baby out into the wilderness. And then he's adopted. And then, like, eventually ends up killing his dad because he didn't know it's actually his dad. It's, like,
for... jump.
Okay, there's, like, stuff that happens in the middle. If you want me to summarize the entire Oedipus trilogy by Sophocles, one, Oedipus Rex, two, Oedipus and Colonus, three, Antigone.
Self-fulfilling prophecies. And if they had managed to not get killed by the Dark One immediately, then I guess they would have been in Ilion when Samael takes over. And if he didn't kill them, then yeah, Matt would have already become a master gleeman based on juggling alone.
And dick sucking?
Yeah.
Ilion is where Matt learns how to suck dick.
Okay. And Rand, I like to imagine, becomes a sailor. He really liked being on that boat.
He did like being on that boat.
He could stay with Bale Dumont's crew, or he could, like, start his own rival crew and die in a storm, tragically.
Amazing. So
he could become Ahab and look for a great right whale.
Okay, yes. I was going to go with a Black Sails parallel.
Ooh,
Bale Dumont is our main. Who would Rand be? Charles Vane?
Rand's... Okay, well, wait. Rand's ginger, so you'd think it would be Flint, but, like, Flint's way too good.
Too
a complicated, competent, gay
character. Rand is
so
aggressively heterosexual.
And that's the problem. There aren't very many aggressively heterosexual Black Sails characters.
Which is good.
He could be the creepy governor who comes in season 3 and marries Eleanor.
Yeah. Oh, he totally would be that guy. I hate that guy.
Yeah. Especially because Eleanor's a lot like Elaine. White feminist.
White feminist nonsense. Eleanor is the worst. Okay, there we go. Rand becomes a sailor, yes. A good, or...
Rand becomes a sailor, somehow manages to evade all the gayness that comes with sailors because he's just that stupid. Matt, meanwhile, gays the hell out of being a bard.
Hell yeah, gayest bard you ever saw.
And Tom...
retires peacefully.
Retires peacefully at the age of 90 and dies in his sleep.
Yeah, dies in his sleep.
Instead,
what we get, Rand becomes Jesus, Matt becomes Alexander the Great? I don't know. That's just what I've gathered.
Yeah, sort of.
And Tom suffers. Does that sound about right with those good predictions?
Alexander the Great is more attached to Rand.
Okay, that's
sorry.
Fair. No, that's fine. I don't know lore.
Matt doesn't have a lot of conquering. Like, a lot of the people that we think of as great generals, like, are great conquerors. Like, Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan and Napoleon, who just, like, conquered huge swaths of territory. But that's more of a Rand vibe, because Rand actually takes over these places and starts governing them. Matt actually just is a brilliant general who doesn't have anything to do with conquering any territories. Yeah, he actually is more of a defender. I'm thinking about warfare. Guerrilla warfare and, like...
So, George Washington?
Yeah, he's got more of a George Washington vibe.
Hell yeah.
Glad we got there eventually.
Hell yeah, I can't believe I made a military connection. I've been friends with Emily for 3 years, this is what you get. You can make one good military reference for every 3 years of friendship.
Oh my god.
That is the 3-to-1 ratio.
Hey, we passed our 3-year anniversary. We didn't even...
No, we didn't. It's in June.
What month is it?
It is March.
I really thought it was May for a second.
Why? You're right, it is in May. Anniversary of our meeting, May 15th, 16th.
God, okay. What's like our actual anniversary?
Well, that depends on
how
we quantify it.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, Food for thought.
Food for thought. Something to think about. When is our anniversary?
Every day.
Okay.
And in this alternate timeline, Perrin never leaves the forest and just...
Yeah, Perrin just, like, chills with the wolf people, and then Edwin, like, ditches him and is like, I'm gonna go still become the Emerlyn Seed, because that's the only plotline I truly approve of.
Yeah, true. And she definitely doesn't date Gaul, or Gawain.
Can you imagine if Edwin and Gaul dated?
Gaul would be the only man I would approve of Edwin dating.
Can you imagine the power couple that would be? Like,
it'd be incredible.
She'd have an actually competent warder.
The dream,
can
really.
You imagine?
That'd be incredible.
God, I'd love an ale warder. That you're like, incredible. Because they wouldn't be, like, the subservient nonsense that most of the Aes Sedai expect from their warders. Yeah. They'd just be like, fuck you.
Fuck you.
I do what I want.
But I'm still going to protect you because I respect you as a woman and as a witch. Because
I'm fucking cool. As a woman and as a witch, I respect you.
So then, in the middle of pirate crew beef plus the insertion of a new timeline into the string theory universe, the Ilian timeline, Tom's like, we can't go out there because Guild's going to see us. So instead, they crawl out the fucking window.
Yeah. Wait, do they really crawl out
the
window?
They fucking crawl out the window.
I thought they just, like, went through a side door.
I feel like they crawled out the window. That may be wishful thinking.
I love that. They just... totally do go out a window.
Oh my god, they go out a window into an alley, and like, Tom separates the money that they just got back from Damon, and is like, in case we get separated, because Tom's a cool uncle, who's like, savvy as hell, and then he like, goes to scout out what he's doing, which leaves Rand and Matt alone for a little bit to argue about where they're gonna go. Rand is all for Caemlyn still. Matt's kinda like, I think everyone's dead, because I'm depressed as hell, because this dagger's like, fucking up with my mind.
Mm-hmm.
God, I kind of, I want, like, the rewrite of this where Matt doesn't have the dagger.
Yeah, what would that be like?
Yeah, because it would be a totally different support system for Rand, mm-hmm. like, going forward. He'd just be like, yeah.
Yeah, Caemlyn, my dude.
Caemlyn, my dude, that sounds great.
Or would Matt want to go to Ilion?
He might also want to go to Ilion because it would get him away from the Aes Sedai. But I also like to think he'd be really worried about Perrin and Edwin and Nynaeve. Like,
specifically Edwin.
Specifically Edwin, because he loves Edwin.
Yeah, but, like, not in an overbearing way. He's just like, I hope Edwin's okay.
One of my favorite moments in the entire series is at the end of book 3 when Matt's talking to that old lady mm-hmm. about the girls that he needs to rescue from the stone, and she says, like, oh, you love one of them. And he just, like, totally is like, yeah.
Yeah, I do.
In, like, a totally platonic way. I love all of them. Except Elaine.
Matt's like, fuck Elaine.
Matt's like, honestly, Elaine can die, but
Edwin
and
Nynaeve, I do need to save
are my
them.
Girls.
Yeah. Elaine can die.
But anyway, after the alleyway, Tom goes and gets a new cloak and is like, here, take my Gleeman's cloak with my my harp and flute in it. Here you go.
Barden, like burden. It's like his bard's burden. It's full of his bard stuff. So it's a burden.
What?
You said barden, which is like
burden. I know what I said, so.
But do you get the joke that you made?
The joke?
It was funny. It was funny.
No.
It was.
You're so tired.
Don't judge me.
Only God can judge me.
Yes.
Only
Michelle Obama can judge me.
True, though.
Okay, so after Tom passes off his pardon to Rand, he starts, like, changing pocket things, which I just think is a really lovely scene. He's, like, pulling things out of one cloak and, like, stuffing it in his new cloak, which is hilarious.
And Rand's like, this cloak is endless.
Yeah, it is like Mary Poppins bag. Tom's like, pulls out a dog. It was like, basically.
Here's a chihuahua.
Forgot
I had this in here.
It's Matt's new support animal.
He needs one desperately.
Matt needs one super bad.
But then basically they are about to leave, walking in the square, and what should they see but a merge roll?
First we have Tom's tragic nephew backstory.
Oh, fuck, I totally forgot. Oh, yeah. They're like, hey, why are you helping us? And Tom's like, because one of my nephews got into some trouble with the Aes Sedai, and I wasn't around, and he died. And here's the not Cliff Notes version. One of Tom's nephews could channel, but Tom was busy fucking the Queen of Andor.
Yeah.
And couldn't be bothered to go help his nephew. But when he did finally find out about his nephew, he broke up with the Queen of Andor and became a rogue bard.
Yeah. Yeah, grief is weird like that.
Grief's weird like that. So, that's the story of both the royal court of Andor and how Tom's poor nephew, who I know has a weird spelling but is derivative of Owen.
Yeah, it's like O-W-Y
or something. I don't give a fuck.
Like
Owen.
A six A's or something. Yeah. Who knows?
Anyway, Owen died. R.I.P. Owen.
I know. I feel like Owen would be a sweetie.
I know.
Just like, I just want that to be his truth.
It's actually kind of an interesting scene because it's the first time we get the idea of men channeling becoming, like, a tragic thing instead of just, like, something to be feared.
Mm-hmm.
Because the boys are so afraid of it. And especially in that, like, rural setting of the Two Rivers. Like, everyone's so afraid of witchcraft and so terrified of men being able to channel. And here Tom's saying, like, oh, it was someone I knew and someone I was related to. And I can't even, like, talk about it freely because people are so freaked out about it. Mm-hmm. But, like, he was a sweetie and he died because being gentled kills you.
Yeah. And what, this is like a total random thing, but like Tom's story is like super masculine. Like, I was too busy fucking someone to care about my children.
Mm-hmm.
Kate's surrogate children. And then I therefore like have now gone on a weird mission of like not vengeance, but kind of. But I'm also like super into that, even though it has a lot of hallmarkers of like a stupid storyline.
Well, I think it helps that it's his nephew, not like one of his actual children or like a wife or something.
Could you imagine Tom as a dad? An actual dad.
Ugh, don't like it.
Weird, right?
Okay. It also helps that he doesn't tell us he was fucking the Queen of Andor right now. He's just like, I was busy. Like,
parentheses. Fucking the Queen of Andor.
Period. Can you imagine though if they had known? Because Rand meets Morgoth later in this book and he would have looked at her and been like, you fucked Tom Marilyn. And I have so many questions.
Yeah. Honestly.
I mean, we all do. It's a very confusing time.
It is a very confusing. It's also just a confusing pairing. Because again, we've talked about this. Tom is such like a hypersexualized character, but to me it's like
he's a granddad.
Even like as a young person, when he was younger.
Even when he was younger, he's still like what, Morgoth is what, 45? Yeah. Tom's supposed to be like 65.
Yeah. That's gross.
Yeah. Super gross.
First of all. Ugh. And then Morgoth goes the other way with her guard. I don't know if they actually fuck, but she's like,
oh, don't get me
do
started.
They? Ew, gross. I hate that.
I can't with Morgoth's entire plotline. I'm sorry, but it's gonna get bad.
So I've only read like 4 pages of it, and that's like decent. But
it's decent, but it's gonna get worse.
Christ. Okay, so Tom Marilyn gives us his tragic backstory. In passing, they go.
And immediately, because this is a hallmark, once you give someone your tragic backstory, you're immediately then allowed to die.
True. It's like,
that's how it goes. Which is why you should never unlock your tragic backstory. Keep that all bottled up inside your chest. Bring it to your goddamn grave. Oh, wait, you're never going to get to the grave because no one can kill you. You're immortal.
Wow.
That's what I'm saying.
Emily has discovered the secrets of immortality.
Philosopher's Stone who?
True.
Philosopher's Stone? It's emotional damage.
So Edward Elric was there all along.
Yeah. The real Philosopher's Stone was
the
in
emotional
him all
damage
along.
We all carry along inside us.
Okay, but actually it was because, yeah, he had the power. You know, okay, anyway.
I've got the power.
We need to stop talking about Full Metal Alchemist.
I can't. It's so good. Kate, Tom Marilyn. Killed immediately because he gives out his tragic backstory and then it's like,
and
oh,
literally
no.
Gives like signs off his fucking like symbols of identity, his
yeah.
Heart, flute, and cloak is like, hold these, I'm gonna go fucking stab this villainous
demon monster marshmallow
thing.
Yeah,
marshmallow.
I don't know
because it has no face.
Yeah, like a white face.
It has bones.
I don't know. Marshmallow just seemed like a good word. I realize now it's not. So Tom Marilyn goes to fight this murderer.
Dramatic AF. Like, twirls his knives.
Yeah.
Charges it. Basically screams, Fenania and for Aslan!
Yeah.
While the boys just turn tail and run.
Yeah. And, okay, this is not relevant, but one of my favorite things that ever happens is Tom says to Rand, he's like, you're too goddamn tall, can't you slouch? And so while they're running, Rand is like Muppet running around White Bridge because he's like, I'm so tall.
Rand halfway through running is like, oh, Tom told me I need to stop drawing attention to myself with my height. So like, crouches down. And Matt's like,
God damn. Like,
bitch, you're running. Like, everybody's looking. Now you just look like...
Matt's like, can you be normal for once in your fucking life?
Matt's like, you look so stupid. Everybody's looking now because you...
I'm the crazy one.
Yeah. Matt's just, like, talking to his dagger, like, you see this bitch?
Anyway, okay, so Tom's dead. Fuck.
Dead.
Yeah, quotes. Dead in quotes because, the bard dies first, but the bard also never dies.
Bard can't kill a bard. I'm a bad bitch. You can't kill me.
Yeah.
John Marilyn.
Tom is only, like, unconscious. He makes a really good death saving throw in the off screen,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, in nat 20s plus some type of modifier. You don't do modifiers on death saving rolls, but...
You don't?
No.
Okay. Again, like, I've never played...
I don't think. Now
I really, want to know everyone's D&D stats, because Tom's would be just, like, through the roof.
Weirdly, yeah. Because he's on, like, multi-class
he's
a bard, a wizard, a barbarian,
but he's, like, 60. He's just, because he's been alive longer than everyone else, he's just leveled up way more than everyone
else. Yeah, Tom is level 50, multi-class bard and rogue.
Damn.
I figured it out.
What's everyone? Okay, no. We can't,
do
this right now.
We'll have a we'll have another episode. So then, I am interested in the fact that, like, you give someone your tragic backstory, usually it's, like, the mentor, and then they die, and then, yeah, Tom has, like, literally passed off, like, symbols of his identity to Matt and Rand, which, yes, like, Matt and Rand then, like, are able to, like, physically, like, inhabit a part of Tom's identity, which is, like, the Gleeman aspect that allows
like,
them
these
to
are
live.
Literally the tools you need to survive.
Yeah, so, like, that's really interesting, but it's just a very interesting notion that, like, you hand off your emotional labor to somebody, and then they have to carry it, and, like, also along with the guilt that you died for them. Like, it's just, like, no wonder all heroes have such goddamn complexes. You know? Like, it's just weird, and I don't...
Well, it's funny because you'd think that would be immediately undone by Tom, then them finding out that Tom isn't dead in book two. And, like, Rand, of course, runs into Tom and Kyrian and is, like, so relieved. He's so happy. And he's like, I fucking have your harp and flute. Like, I've been carrying it with me. Like, here you go. And Tom, like, God, my precious.
Small boy.
But actually, he gives Tom back his harp and just, like, keeps the flute. And that's kind of interesting because even when... Tom's return to them, that's sort of, like, symbolic of Rand keeping some of the emotional guilt attached to what happened.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're right, he just becomes, like, weighed down, literally, symbolically.
Yeah.
With other people dying for him, which I know we've talked about is really annoying when he applies it specifically to women, as women dying for him.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, of course, if people were dying for you, people, regardless of gender, whatever, were, like, going into battle for you... Like, based on a prophecy, that would be really upsetting.
It would be super upsetting, but it's just, like, yeah, again, I have unpacked why it's annoying when it's women specifically, but, like, so, yeah, I'm just very interested in that. Of course, it would be troubling to Rand to be, like, Tom died for me, and I guess Matt.
Matt was only semi-present
Matt
at
was
the
only
time.
Semi-present. but, yeah, and so then it's, like, now Matt and Rand are on their own. They've been severed from the entire party, anybody who's competent, basically. And this is a very particular, like, what we're entering to is a very particularly important sequence for Rand, because Matt, while physically there, very quickly becomes just, like, mentally not there.
Yeah.
And I was having a really interesting conversation with a coworker today for, like, various reasons about stuff that happened. And she was talking about, like, it's super scary when people start, like, acting really agitated, like, that's really very frightening, but at least you can interact with them, so there's, like, a level of, like, it's still a similar to, like, a human interaction, but as soon as people, like, vacate the presence and, like, stop becoming responsive, it's, like, way more frightening, because there's, like, no way to reach that person, and that's what happens with Matt. Like, he does get, like, angry and agitated, but eventually, like, he just, like, goes completely internal.
Yeah, so Rand basically has, like, a dependent.
Yeah.
Which is Matt. And just, like, is dragging him through this, like, stretch of road, this stretch of straight road to Caitlin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Matt will have his back a couple of times, but, like, God, like, it's just fucked up.
Yeah.
So and really important for, like, the hero's journey and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
blah,
because
blah,
this is, like, the moment where Rand as a hero is quote-unquote made, because he is entirely alone.
Mm-hmm.
More or less, and, like, he has to do something by himself.
So. And it's interesting that he doesn't do anything particularly, like, heroic or selfless in this time period.
Yeah.
He's just going to survive. like.
Mm-hmm. Rand's, like you mentioned last episode, Rand's specific iteration of the hero's journey is in many ways very interesting because, yes, he's doing these, like, world-altering battles, but, like, a lot of the key stuff that he does is very much, like, attached to survival.
And trying to survive intact.
Yeah, just, like, getting through.
Mm-hmm.
So
on that note.
Very interesting.
A vaguely positive stuff about Rand.
Yeah, vaguely positive.
Yeah, let's be done.
Housekeeping. You should hopefully, if you've made it to episode 9, know all of our socials, but Everybody Hates Rand, find us on Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram, and our Gmail is everybodyhatesrand@gmail.com. We're getting, like, okay, not, like, super close, but, like, fairly close to the end of the Eye of the World.
Or about the midway point.
About the midway point. But that means, you know, we're getting along there, and as Emily's mentioned in past episodes, we're going to do, like, a Q&A type thing in between this book and the next book. So if you have questions, send them to us. They can be Wheel of Time related, ideally, or literature related, or I don't know how willing Emily is to answer personal questions, but you can ask me what my favorite color is and I'll super answer.
I just told you that the secret to immortality is keeping your...
It's why I'm already dead.
I will not answer personal questions truthfully, but I will make up a thrilling tale.
I'm not talking about personal questions, like, tell me your childhood trauma, but, like...
You tell them your childhood trauma every episode.
Okay, but not, like, the real ones.
Okay, well.
But, true. Like, if you just are like, hey, lads, what do you think of dinosaurs? And I will tell you in detail why I love them.
She's wearing a Brontosaurus necklace right now that I gave her.
Yeah.
Hey, you need to go watch RuPaul and I need to do anything but this, so.
Okay.
Sign us off.
There's multiple traumas to talk about. in a bit of divine irony, the literally 5 minutes after I got my driver's permit, I walked outside, opened the car door, and hit myself so hard in the face that I started bleeding and have a scar on my forehead. Yeah, that's what that's from. I opened my mother's car door and, like, hit myself so hard in the face. It's like this little tiny scar over my eyebrow. And I was bleeding profusely because the head bleeds a lot. There's a lot of, like, blood vessels there. And my mom just was, like, in the car, and I was, like, cupping blood in my hands. And she was like, I think we should go to Target. And I was like, maybe we should go to the hospital. I didn't need stitches or anything. It actually wasn't that bad. But she looked over and she's like, why are we... Oh, my God.
I think we should go to Target.
Bye.